All right, let's welcome our guest. Until Julius Comes is his new book. It is available at all good bookstores countrywide. The subtitle, Adventures in the Political Jungle. It covers the period roughly from a couple of months before the election to just after. And it's an amazing array of some of your best stuff that you've been putting in the Daily Maverick. How long does it take you to put one of these articles together? Because the language is just incredible. I would imagine you craft each piece.
Well, first of all, thank you. You know, these pieces were interesting because they're really written in the fire. You know, you get this incredible energy. I think anybody who's covered an election, I'm sure you guys feel the same over here. There's this insane, intense sort of nuclear energy that bubbles around the whole proceeding. And so you get the
despite
fire in the, your belly.
Despite every attempt by Oscar Pistorius to steal the limelight.
He did give it a shot. He did give it a shot. But, you know, it was, you know, so you write the stuff in the fire. Some of them are written really, really quickly. I don't think many more of them took much more than 4 hours or so. But, you know, it's the culmination of years of work, just, you know, getting your chops up, getting your muscles built. So, yeah, but they were written hectically quickly with a lot of whiskey.
I want to read you a piece of this. I never like to read stuff on the air, but this is just magnificent. When you wrote about the death of Madiba, because this is probably the only chapter in this whole book where you are, I suppose, a little, you're almost, and I don't want to use the word that you're sensitive about it, because you're not. It's more that you allow a little bit of your own real feeling about this whole thing to spill over and become slightly sentimental. Mm-hmm. There's no other point in the book where you do this, but just listen to this quickly. The designated period of mourning was meant as a squaring away, as a time of remembrance, and for those of us with an almost ancient fortitude, for those of us able to ignore the industrial-grade noise-a-thon, the tumble of tweets, the slew of selfies, the unceasing bullshit factory that is the 24-hour news cycle, for those of us able to tune it all out, perhaps those 10 days actually contained something meaningful, rather than its inverse. When Madiba was pronounced dead and the official statement was catapulted into the techno-ether, I could feel it before I knew it. I don't mean feel in the spiritual sense of the term, although I wish I did. Rather, I heard the news choppers above me, and I could feel the information hurtling through what remains of my soul into smartphones, iPads, TVs, computers, times 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, in which I wasn't part of the clutter. And then it began. I mean, this is just, you have such an incredible way of writing about things that everybody who was around at that time would have felt something like that, but we can't put it into words as well as you do. That's a hell of a thing you got going on there.
Well, thanks, but yeah, I suppose that's why I get paid the medium-sized buck.
You don't hold back. I just want to dwell on the book for a minute more and then find out more about you, but you don't hold back on these politicians. You nail them all repeatedly. You said that every time you see Helen Ziller, you think you're in that Braveheart movie and she's covered in war paint and blood.
Yeah, and coming towards me with a spear. Yeah, it's these. Does our political culture have to be like this? Does it really? I just don't think it does.
Isn't it exciting?
It gives you material. It certainly does, and it is insane. But I mean, you know, I think it would be fun if I was, you know, writing about kittens and puppies and, you know, I think I could make something out of that as well.
No, you'd be bored to death.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, I mean, look, it's ludicrous, and I don't think they're gonna change their ways anytime soon. But yeah, I just there's no one who doesn't get pounded down in the book.
Maybe the best, I don't know, one of the things I love about this is when you write about Mampela Rampele, and you said that she's so fragile, she's made of just dust and ideas and bullshit, and she's held together by her makeup. I mean, it's just incredible. Like you. And you get an idea that that's exactly what she is. She's a hollow person. And you said that long before anybody else did. And you said it before the DA Ahang merger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a genuinely creepy person. Yeah, I mean, she just is.
And why do white businessmen love her so much?
That is the abiding question. I mean, basically because she's a black female vessel for all of their right-wing hardcore business ideas.
She's Ayn Rand, almost.
She's the black South African Ayn Rand. She does not want to give handouts to anybody. No tax breaks. No food packets. God forbid. No RDP housing. Absolutely not. Yeah. You know, we will redress all of our differences and all of the ills of our racial segregation and legacy simply by hard work and soap.
And by being like her, because she puts herself at the center of everything.
100%. So her experience...
Total narcissist.
Complete narcissist. I mean, her... Not everybody is like her. We all can't, you know, we can't all be doctors four times over and, you know, have run the World Bank badly.
Badly.
I should add.
Also ran the UCT badly. She was the worst vice chancellor they've ever had. People don't talk about this.
No. They don't, you know, that was the thing. Nobody has actually scrutinized her CV.
No.
The way...
They want to take on the dream.
Yeah, exactly. She's a vessel for white male businessmen. That's basically what she is. And she's absolutely unapologetic about it. Hard work, man. Hard work and soap. That's the way we'll move forward.
I can't help it. Neither does the forward write. Rian Malan writes the forward to your book, and he says he brings up the inevitable comparison to Hunter S. Thompson. Now, Hunter S. Thompson is probably one of the greatest journalists of all time. He took journalism in brave new directions that it had never gone in. He wrote a scathing, horrendous, vitriolic eulogy to Richard Nixon that I read once. It's probably the meanest eulogy of all time, but it's fantastic because he doesn't apologize. He goes straight for the kill. He brings up all the things about Richard Nixon that we're pleased we don't have to deal with anymore.
Yeah, that is a stunning piece of writing.
It is. Mm-hmm. It's probably one of the best things I've ever read, which is why it sticks in my mind so much. But you've got that same, you know, you're not the same. And I don't think there's anything about Hunter S. Thompson that you have in common in terms of style, but you're brave. You don't mind saying outrageous things. Like you wrote a piece on Gandla. What did you call that piece that I read just a short while ago? It was recent. Well, you wrote about Gandla and the president. And the headline was something uncontrolled creep.
So
that was what it was.
So the where that headline comes from is, and I mean, this is just because the ANC and so many of our leaders are actually better at language than most of the country's writers are. I mean, they're geniuses when it comes to spinning this stuff. And Kandler wasn't a means of actively ripping off the taxpayers of this country. It was just a case of uncontrolled creep.
That's what Tuli Madonsela said.
Bingo.
Right.
So you're like,
and he is the uncontrolled creep.
This is it.
So you just married the two together and wrote the most beautiful piece about what a creep he is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, that's where so much of this material comes from, is the fact that these guys, you know, they're Orwellian spin doctors, constant, 24/7, just spinning, and you know, pounding language into pulp. And it's fun to play with that.
It is if you're a great writer, and it's great as a reader of the stuff that you write. But do you think most South Africans get it?
Yeah, I think most South Africans get the fact that they're being bullshitted all the time. I think they do. I'm not sure how many people feel they can do anything about it. But I think there's a hell of a lot of anger out there, and it comes from the fact that people feel bullshitted constantly, all the time.
What was your overwhelming sense after these elections? Because there's a lot to be depressed about. There's a lot to be hopeful about. There's very little to be immediately optimistic about.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the thing. I think there was a sort of mixture of, you know, let's put it in perspective. These were basically violence-free elections. I mean, yes, there were some incidents, and it was, you know, it was horrible seeing.
You went to Bekkersdorp?
Yeah. And the military presence there was just gruesome. You know, and it was totally reminiscent of the kind of thing we saw in this country in the 80s. And, you know, it was power protecting itself, and it's always horrible to see that kind of thing. That said, for the most part, these were free and fair elections, insofar as any election is free and fair. The flip side is that, you know, people just didn't feel spoiled for choice. They really, really didn't.
Mm.
And the sort of misery that the status quo was basically unchanged post-election, I suppose was inevitable, and most of us were braced for it. Are there reasons to feel hopeful? Yeah, I suppose there are, because we saw some sort of shift happening, at least on the radical left, and that's largely due to the EFF. Now, whether or not one, you know, can get behind a movement like that isn't really the point. The point is there's some fractures happening, and those fractures will be either sink this country or allow it to move in, forward into the future and build.
We don't have a middle road to choose here. We're either going for the best or we're going to go sinking down.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of the interesting thing about a middle-income country like this one and why it's so depressing to watch it muddle its way through the sort of mud of mediocrity that we're in right now. There is no middle way for us. We can't muddle along Jacob Zuma style. We actually have to do stuff. We actually have to implement a whole bunch of programs that are going to move, first of all, people forward, and second of all, the country forward. We can't do what we're doing now. It's not going to work out.
No, you're being very serious. I want to know about you. You were born here, but you grew up in Canada.
No, I grew up here. I moved to Canada when I was about 17.
Okay.
Yeah, and I went to art school there. I went to film school over there. Right. I was going to be Steven Spielberg. And
you look like a film director.
Yeah, it didn't work out so good. I ended up shooting Toyota Tercel commercials and, you know, hip hop videos where the, you know, where it was sort of like, we need a Maybach now.
Make it happen.
Yeah, make it happen. That was my job. And then to somehow, you know, get a low angle shot of a woman in pink shorts straddling said Maybach.
That doesn't sound like a bad career, if you ask me. That sounds pretty damn good.
Oh no, man, it was sort of soul destroying. I think it was the last Toyota Tercel commercial that sort of did me in, and I just cold turkey quit. I was like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I can't sell Toyotas. You know, I love the cars, but I can't do it anymore. But
having a way with words, though, you must have known that ultimately you would be writing.
Yeah. You know, it was.
And now you can do it full time.
Yes, I mean, it was one of those things where. Yeah, no disrespect to the craft of filmmaking.
We're talking about making commercials.
Yeah, you know, it was a dead end for me, and I wanted to be on the road. I wanted to be speaking to people. I wanted to be getting stuff in my notebooks. I wanted to be on the road. I wanted to be traveling.
Didn't you just come back from the Central African Republic?
I did. I got back from the Central African Republic.
Oh, so, were you on holiday or something?
Yeah, it was a nice place to go for a holiday.
Took a week-long break.
Yeah, you know, just...
You went there for a tickle and massage, huh?
Nice package deal.
Oh, my God.
Yikes.
So things are looking up for me. I mean, you know, it's all uphill. You know, it's amazing.
What is going on there?
It's mayhem. It's absolute mayhem. First of all, the country is in complete disarray. There was a breakaway. Part of the north broke away from the south on Monday while we were there. We did a lot of time on the road in a 4x4 that wasn't up for it, and you know, we had some really, really scary moments. I mean, that country is as raw as it comes. It was unreal.
And where did you stay?
Well, we stayed in Bangui for about for a few days. We stayed.
That's showed the capital.
We showed up at a Catholic mission in a little town in Grimerie, and thankfully the priest took us in one night. I stayed in an army base run by the AU forces over there, who are called Miska. A Gabonese captain took us in, mm-hmm. so we wouldn't have to die in the bush. It was wild. It was proper sort of insanity. The truck broke down. We encountered rebels on the route. It was nuts.
What a horrible place. Why do you go to places like this?
You know, because they aren't all horrible. That's the funny thing. It's as with anywhere in the world, the people are awesome until they're not. And it's kind of, I guess what my job is finding the point where the people stop being nice and when they start being really, really horrible. And with Carr, it's fairly obvious. The fact is that the people have been screwed over constantly. And this is what happens. The place just explodes.
What is really going on there? What's the actual fight about? Is it tribal? Is it religious? Is it political?
I would say it's political. It always comes down to the fact that, you know, power is what power is. And in the government trying to make sure that they keep hold of those resources and keep pumping them out to the French and the South Africans and the Israelis, everybody else has got screwed.
It's greed, isn't it? Because you've written very, very much about greed in your book. In fact, I would think that is almost an underlying theme, is that there's this kleptocracy that rules over South Africa, where people get into politics not because they want to serve the people, but because they want to enrich themselves. It's pure base greed. It's the most horrible of all human qualities. And you talk about things like e-tolls, and you interviewed Wayne Duvenage and who's the other dude?
John Clark,
mm-hmm. who basically took on, back in the Transkei, the government in SANRAL. And
that's an amazing case.
And hardly anybody knows about that. Mm. But that's one of the reasons that they got together and that Wayne quit his job at Avis and started doing this full time to start ARTA, you know, the Opposition Against Urban Tolling Alliance. And what it is, you put very clearly in your book, that this whole e-toll thing is not so much about paying for roads or policy that's gone right or wrong. It's purely another harebrained scheme to make money out of ordinary people in this country, to pulverize and squeeze every last drop of money and blood out of the South African public by the government.
You're a pretty good writer.
But that's I'm not quoting you verbatim, but I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's and that is what the book comes down to. And when you ask what's going on in Carr, it's basically one big e-toll. It always comes down to this.
What do you say to horrible, traitorous, terrible people like Leanne Moll who've got an e-tag? How do you deal with people like that in public? I mean, she's embarrassed, but she did it anyway.
And I should have kept quiet.
Yeah, you should have. That is something. That's like the ultimate South African shame. is admitting that you have
a. I mean, you'd be better off being a racist or being a sexist or a bigot.
I'm not even going to explain myself.
I'm tired of it.
You'd be better off choosing a side in Israel and Gaza.
I feel terrible.
Much better off. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You're not afraid, though, also to go into things that people don't want to talk about, like saying who you voted for or whatever, because that's a big deal in this country. Do publications back a certain party? Do individuals publicly admit who they back? And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But we're nowhere near the stage where America is at, where people are proudly this. And they almost now have gone to the extreme of being proudly that to the exclusion of any reasonable argument otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is one of the things I like, I prefer about the media here to the American media is the fact that we don't endorse. I actually like that because it's one of these things where at least there's some sort of pretense of.
Richard, we're getting there, because if you look at publications like The New Age, which is clearly, we know where The New Age sit, we know who's paying them, we know where their loyalties lie, so we know when we read The New Age, we're getting a certain kind of news. And a lot of people like that. They want to hear the government side of things.
Yeah, look, a lot of people just want their own prejudices and their own ideas reconfirmed and reconfirmed and reconfirmed. And if you're pro-government, then the New Age does a very, very good job of that. I don't know if you've read that rag of late, but
I don't. I've got to tell you, I don't. I try to give them a chance. There are probably a few journalists there who deserve a chance. I don't know.
I don't know why you'd sign up for a publication like that. Quite frankly,
you have to lack integrity if you're just doing it for the paycheck.
No, you absolutely do. There's no reason to go to work for a paper like that, other than the fact that you're a shill. You're selling.
Have you ever, despite being such a good writer and in such demand, have you ever had to write something and it just disagreed with your conscience so much that you pulled out, you resigned, you refused to do it, you had to redraft it, you decided it wasn't you? Like it was a major ethical dilemma for you.
You know, I think early in your career you get into situations like that because you just don't have the options. But, you know, I think I started in kind of a smart way, and that was that I started trade publications. So, you know, you're going out and just, you know, learning how to craft these pieces, just doing the job in a fairly banal way. So I've never really encountered an ethical dilemma like that. But I was working for a Canadian publication, a very large one, the national publication. And if there's another scumbag I can't stand on the planet, it's the Prime Minister of Canada.
Who is the current Prime Minister of
Canada? His man named Stephen Harper.
What happened to Chrétien? He was the previous one.
Yeah, he quit. He was old.
So tell me about this Harper dude that you
can't stand. He's sort of like a right-wing nut. Evangelical, closet, nutcase, I guess.
Jesus, it doesn't sound good.
Yeah, he's
and he's
bad,
in charge of Canada.
Man. And he's running Canada, sort of like what the United States, what the Republican Party in the United States wishes they're running America like. He's far right of the American right.
Hold on a second. Mm. How does this happen in a place that says supposedly first world and peaceful and without real issues? They don't really have issues in Canada. How does this guy get in power?
Apathy. Canadians were sleeping in the snow.
They don't care.
Yeah, man. And when the snow thawed, they realized they had, you know, a loon running the country. So I wrote a piece about this guy, and I wrote another piece about him. And the national newspaper told me that I needed to back off Stephen Harper.
You're kidding.
Yeah. words in the email from the top, back off Stephen Harper. And I saw that email, and you get, you know, this feeling of just like sheer, are you joking? Back off Stephen Harper? How about Stephen Harper backs off me? You know, because they were getting pressure right from the PM's office for me
to
back
off. It must make you happy. It's on some level that you actually got his attention.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, but then you're cut off. Yeah. And I've never written copy for them since.
But have you written some stuff about him?
Oh yeah.
Oh good. I must look for that immediately. Yeah, something tells me it'll be nice and saucy.
Yeah, I was not terrified, but by their injunction by any means. So that was a real lesson. I mean, you know, one of the great things about the Daily Maverick is the fact that that doesn't happen. You know, there's never a back off, you know, Helen Ziller or back off Jacob Zuma.
I can't imagine Branko calling you and going, "Listen, I don't want you doing this."
Yeah, the Serbian maniac is not about to put a leash on.
I mean, we've got to get Branko in here one morning, Damon, the editor of the Daily Maverick. Branko has lived a life. I mean, you heard about what he got up to in Serbia.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Slobodan Milosevic's wife. Yeah. I mean, massive, just unbelievable stories. He's lucky to be alive.
Yeah, he is lucky to be alive. So yeah, there's no backing off at the Daily Maverick.
Who in South Africa do you think is the most horrible, onerous, ornery, cruel, selfish person that we should avoid at all costs? Because there's a range of them. Who would you like to zero in on? And if you could dedicate your life to destroying the career of this horrible person, it would be...
My God, that is an amazing question. I sort of have like a rotational hit list. Yeah, you know, I don't know. Is I think Cloudy's on it today.
Yeah, you know, he's a turd.
Yeah,
huh?
He really is he is the lowest of the low. You know, and it's kind of like the good guys always go down and the bad guys just get built up. I mean, I can't stand Jacob Zuma. I don't understand him. Cyril Ramaphosa, I just don't understand him.
You don't like Cyril, huh?
I'm not a big Cyril fan at all.
Do you dislike him in the same vein that Mampela is like an
empty vessel. Yeah, absolutely.
And Cyril's now he's made his money, now politics, and now he wants glory.
And now he wants glory. Now
you think he's vain?
President, there's that, but he's also, look, I mean, he is, he works for mining houses.
Right.
That's what he does. He's their go-to guy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care about this country. He just doesn't. And I mean, maybe taking Cyril down would be a fun thing.
Is it inevitable he'll be the president next?
It's Dlamini Zuma or Ramaphosa, as far as I'm concerned. So that's those are the two who are in the ring. I mean, I'd take Dlamini Zuma over Ramaphosa any day.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a Cyril fan, as you can hear.
And outside the ruling party, are you? Who worries you?
Look, I mean, the EFF are really, really, really interesting. I had a lot of fun covering their rallies. I had a lot of fun with Juju. I had a lot of fun with
Floyd. He's like a bag of sweets for a journalist.
Yeah, he is. He's the gift that keeps on giving.
And Andile Nditama as well.
These guys are really, really, really interesting. They're a journalist's wet dream. I mean, it doesn't get any better than the EFF.
Man.
And it's no accident that the book is called Until Julius Comes, because he's here. And I think it's the most fascinating political story in this country.
Are you trying to be provocative with that title? Are you trying to frighten white people into buying your book?
I always like to frighten white people a little bit. You know, I mean, it's healthy for white people to be frightened every now and again.
Did you know that Richard Poplack plays polo? Did you know that?
That is
very elitist sport. That
That is giving me a little too much credit. I was taught how to play polo
in the Western Cape, but you don't play anymore. You don't play
Jesus. I can barely ride a horse. I was taught how to play in a piece. the magazine that preceded the Daily Maverick was called The Maverick, and it was an amazing magazine that Branko put together, and I still mourn its untimely death.
Yes,
but he sent me out to the Western Cape to hang out with the Toffs and to learn how to play polo.
Yes.
My testicles have actually never been the same.
Tell me, talking about that.
Speaking of my testicles.
There are some subcultures in this country that we really don't fully understand. These white rich people in the Western Cape, for example, are different to white rich people in Gauteng or anywhere else.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Tell me about them, because you immersed yourself in their culture. What have they got going on in their heads there? You talk about shrimp braais from Camps Bay penthouses and things like that in your book.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about...
By the way, can you tell I read your book?
Yes, you've read the book. You know, one of the amazing things about Cape Town, and I think I'm going to work on a project next that uses Cape Town very heavily, is that it hasn't changed at all since Jan van Riebeck founded it, 400-odd. Not at all. I mean, it's still a colonial way station that is walled off from the rest of the country that has one purpose, high-end vegetables. It's organic food to it's an unbelievable place. And so it has this, because it's walled off from the rest of the country, and because it's still predominantly, the power is almost entirely white.
Yeah.
And the economy in Cape Town is almost entirely white. It has this ring-fenced mentality that basically hasn't changed much since 1843. So when you go into a gathering in Cape Town, not much has changed. You know, the canapes are still, they look like they would have looked 200 years ago. It's still pink gin and tonics. It's
and
still
a whole lot of entitled people.
And a whole lot of entitled people. Look, not everybody in Cape Town's like that. I have to say that.
I mean, you've got the hippies. You've got the hipsters.
You've got
these colonial kinds. Mm. But white people in the Western Cape really don't think that they're different to the rest of South Africa. But they're very different. And that's why they never leave there.
And, you know, one of the amazing things about African cities is that they're always their essences. You know, Johannesburg is still a mining town.
It is.
You know.
And it's rough and it's always, and it's aggressive.
Everybody's hustling.
And it's not pretty.
Yeah.
But we get things done.
We get things done.
Durban is real Africa, if you ask me, in some ways. Because you can go to a market there and God knows you could probably buy a gorilla hand or something. But right next door you got the Hilton Hotel.
Yeah.
And you've got this kind of Miami-esque Indian crossed with Zulu, crossed with English, smorgasbord of cultures and tastes and frankly, quite horrible mixes of culture and language.
Do you think so?
I think there's something about Durban that's very coarse, but I like it.
No, I like it.
It's real.
Like it.
It's got a little more reality to it than any other city.
No, I think it's sort of one of the most underrated cities I've visited.
It's very cosmopolitan.
Very rich, but hardcore. I mean, it's a rough town.
I would rather go into the middle of Johannesburg at midnight than I would the middle of Durban.
If you have a choice. Yeah.
That's all I'm trying to say.
But Cape Town's essential essence. It hasn't changed. It really, really hasn't changed. It hasn't, to use a great South African word, progressed. And that makes it, very, very interesting and kind of hilarious.
Talking about subcultures, you've written about these Germans in Namibia. That's an interesting thing because those people were practically, like there were a whole lot of Nazis that basically lived in Southwest Africa at the time and escaped detection.
Mm. God, that's a strange place. I mean, I remember the first time I rolled in there into the proper sort of German subculture over there. I was with another journalist, Kevin Bloom, and we'd spun out our car on a dirt road, and we were rattled, man. We just needed to get somewhere with beer as soon as possible. And, it was one of those days, driving through the desert all day, and we rolled into Swakopmund.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've been there.
No.
But it is a trip, man. It's like a German colonial town that has Springbok schnitzel on the menu. You know, it's like Africa meets German, but not pure German. The accents are so pure. They have changed not at all since these guys got there a couple of hundred years ago, that they can't understand these guys in Berlin.
It's almost the way that Mexicans speak Spanish since before the revolution.
Bingo. It's that exact same phenomenon.
It's pure German.
And so we stayed at the Hansa Hotel.
Hochdeutsch.
Hochdeutsch.
Yeah,
yes.
There we go.
So we stayed at the Hansa Hotel, which is the old colonial hotel there, and we were taken under the wing by a guy, a chef who had worked there called Sheffy. They're very imaginative with names in Swakopmund. So Sheffy took us around. And showed us the town, and he took us to the cemetery. He goes, here is where the Christians are buried. It's awesome. He goes, that is over there behind the trees is the Jews.
Oh my God, no! You're
kidding. Behind the Jews is the blacks.
Wow, this is all just across our border.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that is a strange phenomenon.
You've also spent some time. I mean, this is amazing. You've been to some countries I would love to go to. You've checked out the Muslim world quite in quite a lot of detail. You've written about like Americanization of Muslim Saudi culture, especially.
Well, yeah. I mean, I spent a couple of years looking at how American pop culture sort of influenced and changed Muslim cultures, and this was before the Arab Spring. So, you know, this was when the idea of the Muslim world, certainly in the West and even in South Africa, was, you know, it's immutable, it's unchangeable, it's always going to be the same. These people are living in, you know, the 14th century caliphates, and nothing's ever going to change.
Pure unadulterated autocracy. Yeah. And I say unadulterated for very good reasons, too.
Yeah. So, you know, and then there was this youth subculture that was bubbling below it, which I sort of learned about when I heard that there was a Arab translation of The Simpsons.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But The Simpsons is quite progressive and I would say a little left-leaning and sometimes socially quite critical.
It's totally satirical. But how do you translate that for a country or culture that just is completely at odds with everything that The Simpsons sort of satirizes, I guess? And this was being done in Dubai. So I spoke to a publishing company and they're like, go check it out, see what happens. So I went and sort of chased down the story and it was just the most bizarre thing. I mean, they had cut out all references to Rabbi Krestovsky. Homan no longer drank beer, he drank juice.
Oh.
It was Duff Juice.
What a boring show.
You know, oh my God, the show was so boring. But that sort of got me on the road and kept me on the road just looking at, you know, car culture and...
And these sheiks who have all this money.
Yeah, they were spending it. One dude built a bespoke car dealership in Dubai. He built all three of the Batmobiles from the Christopher Nolan movies.
But it's too much money and
but
too much
worked,
time.
But they worked. They worked. They're rocket-powered.
Jesus.
You know, so this
Hollywood can't even make that.
No. Those things, yeah, they're computer-generated. This dude made them.
Wow.
Yeah. He sent one of them down Sheikh Zayed Road with him in it. I think he did something like 350 kilometers on it or something. Yeah, it was lunacy. But you know, some of the impulses, I was convinced that some of what's in American pop, this idea of being an individual, of individuals will overcome, you know, all of that stuff had sort of been imbibed and sort of taken in by these cultures. And it was really interesting. I was in Indonesia, in a really restive region of the country. And this very famous musician, he's one of the big rock musicians, said to me, he said, we don't need less Hollywood movies in this country. We need more Hollywood movies. We need to learn how to be strong individuals. We need to learn how to be Superman, Captain America. That's what we need. More, not less. And it was one of these bizarre...
That's interesting.
You know,
you'd think, especially in the Far East, where kind of the community, the corporation, is valued over the individual.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear that.
The beehive mentality, as opposed to everybody matters and everyone's an individual.
Yeah, you're right. And then in Egypt, I was hanging out with the metalheads over there.
There are metalheads in Egypt.
There are metalheads in Egypt. It was
These bizarre small subcultures. Isn't it amazing? In Egypt, who would have thought there were metalheads?
They have a really really established metalhead culture over there. And these guys had come in for pounding after pounding by the Mubarak government. I mean, he had just done them in. And they were on the front lines of the Arab Spring. I mean, those were some of the first guys in Tahrir Square.
Metalheads. No, we don't hear about that. We hear about the Muslim Brotherhood and that kind of thing. We don't hear about
this
the metalheads.
This is the thing, though. You know, all these great stories get buried under the sort of, you know, the media consensus. It's
not with you. That's why we've got to read your stuff.
What do you know about the Yazidis? Because they seem to be having a tough time as well.
These people are suffering, man.
Yeah, they are literally on the mountain. So hopefully the Americans can bomb them free, but they're not having a great run of it.
How do you feel about American imperialism, as they call it, if they're criticizing it? You know, I'm a fan of America, and I think if America doesn't police the world, it'll all fall to pieces. Everybody says, oh, America, this bunch of assholes, and we don't need them involving themselves in our affairs. But as soon as things go wrong, who do they look to for help? America.
Look, you're right. The interesting thing about what's happened over the course of this nightmarish last 3 months is the fact that you've got a president in the United States who seems to be saying, oh, you didn't want to help? Okay, well, we're just going to sit this one out. And it's all gone to shit in a handbag.
Exactly.
With the rapidity that is almost dizzying.
Yeah,
that's
Syria, the Iraq, Afghanistan's in turmoil again. We've got problems in Gaza. We've got problems in Libya.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Ukraine. I mean, my God, it's all, the wheels seem to be coming off. That said, America's an interesting place. You look at what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri right now.
Jeez.
And, you know, they have their National Guard on the streets. Ferguson looks like, you know, Joburg did during the DA-ANC nightmares over the course of the election. There's obviously cracks in that machine. And there's a lot of things they have to fix. Their foreign policy mistakes always go back to Iraq in 2003.
George W. Bush created...
What a moron. I mean, he probably is the king. Well, him and Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Was he the moron or was his father the moron? I mean, who was worse?
Sort of like
George Sr. or...
No, George Sr. was quite a smart guy. I mean, he was competent.
Well, at least he had run the CIA, not terribly.
Yeah.
Look, it's sort
just
of like
a bureaucrat, this really.
Cascading idiots. Think about a waterfall of stupidity.
Oh.
That foreign policy whim that they undertook to depose Saddam Hussein must reign as the stupidest thing a major power has done since, I don't know, ancient Rome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Since Nero let the city burn. Let's go to Lebo. Hey, Lebo, you want to talk to Richard?
Hi, yes. Hi, Richard.
How's it, Lebo?
Good, thanks. Damon told me not to ask you how are you. But anyway, I just wanted to say I loved your book, Norman.
Thank
is
you.
The title.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the first time that I actually read a book that told me about apartheid South Africa from a white perspective that was not political or anything like that, just as an everyday white South African. And it really opened my eyes. And especially the part about your racist boodle dog that you had.
Yeah.
I think its name was Chomps or something.
Yeah, Chomps, wow. The racist boodle. Yeah.
It was absolutely hilarious. And the part where you talk about the camp where you went to, we went to a similar camp, by the way. So you can imagine little black kids in the Model C schools going to this camp with these Afrikaans.
We did that too. Did you write about that? I must read this book.
Felt school, yeah.
Yeah, we had to go to
hilarious.
Felt school. What a stupid thing that was. If ever there was a moment where I thought I was being indoctrinated, it was
well,
there.
That was the moment you were being indoctrinated.
Yeah. It was the most I had laughed about apartheid, believe it or not. It was incredibly funny. And these worms and that boy was lactose intolerant. It was absolutely hilarious.
Thanks, Lebo. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I'm a big fan, so if that's anything to go by, I'm definitely getting Until Julius comes today.
So all right.
I just wanted to say thank you for that.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lebo.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Matt Black wants to know on WeChat, for Richard, what is the CAR like as a landscape? Is it pretty? Is it tropical? Is it poor? Is it just dusty? What's the landscape like there?
I mean, he pretty much summed it up. Well,
it's
you
all
summed
of those
it up.
Things.
It's all of those things. It's amazing. It's alternately dusty and muddy. How do you pull that off? It
doesn't
sort of
sound
like
good.
A mud dust combo.
Didn't they have? They had a lake there, Lake Chad, in Central Africa, which has completely disappeared.
Mm.
It's basically been emptied.
Yeah, due to some activities in the north. But the interesting, it's quite beautiful. I mean, it's the rawest jungle I've seen. There is absolutely no development whatsoever outside of the cities. The 385K route that we took from Bangui, the capital, to Bambari, which is the center of the fighting, it's what they call the fracture zone in the country, was the worst road I've ever traveled in my entire life. But, you know, we encountered dozens of these small villages and small towns. Again, they've never seen electricity, and I'm not sure they ever will. I think they're going to skip the sort of industrial age and go straight to some new form of energy, you know, small glowing lamps, you know, lithium ion batteries. It's bizarre. It's a very, very raw place.
I could talk to you all day, but I'm going to see you tonight at your book launch.
Yeah.
And all the best with this book. It's a work of art.
Thank you, Gareth.
This is one of those things that I think people will look at in 100 years time and go, this actually, now I can see what was happening, because it's a feeling thing as much as it is an intellectual exercise. I just love the way you use language. Finishes off by saying, that you bumped into a guy at a dinner party who asked you who you're voting for. You said, if I had that dinner conversation after you'd gone through the whole thing and, you know, worked out what had happened during the elections, you said, if I had that dinner conversation over again, I'd answer like this. I endorse the South African soul, a soul that is preternaturally aware of the evils of oppression, a soul that has absorbed indescribable amounts of pain. I would remind my interlocutor that we were each given names, not numbers, not dompasses, in order to forestall injustice. I'd remind him that freedom demands unwavering vigilance, and vigilance is less lonely when 50 million individuals, each with their own name and their own signal tremor, are watching along with you. Yo. Good stuff. Richard Kaplak, thank you so much, man.
All right, I'll see you tonight.
Absolutely. What a great book. It's called Until Julius Comes, Adventures in the Political Jungle, Richard Poplack. And it's available at good bookstores now. What an incredible piece of writing. And take a look at it. Our own Hunter S. Thompson with us this morning.